This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. With the Iowa caucuses coming up next week, the election year is about to enter a new phase, at least for the Democrats. Before we get subsumed in the details of the 2004 election, we wanted to take a step back to talk about the two institutions that we'll be talking about through Election Day, the Republican and Democratic parties. At various times over the years, both have been dismissed as moribund or irrelevant or outdated, but thus far they've survived every third-party challenge and totally dominate American politics. Random House has just published two books that trace the history of the two parties. Today we'll talk about Grand Old Party, A History of the Republicans, with its author, historian Lewis Gould. Tomorrow, Party of the People, A History of the Democratic Party, with its author, journalist Jules Witkover. Later in the program, a State Department conference revisits the controversy over the attack on the USS Liberty during the 1967 Six-Day War. But first, the history of the Republican Party. How did it begin and develop? Are there ideas and principles we can trace from the start 150 years ago that still animate the party today? Who and what shaped the GOP, and how has it shaped America? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Lewis Gould joins us now from the studios of member station KUT in Austin, Texas. In addition to writing this new history, he's professor emeritus in American history at the University of Texas, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you for having me.
Remind us of the historical circumstances that prompted the creation of a new party a century and a half ago.
The key element was the submission of the Kansas-Nebraska Act to Congress in early 1854 by Stephen A. Douglas. And what made this act so central was that it reopened the question of whether slavery could be legal in the Western territories, something that people thought had been settled 34 years earlier in the Compromise of 1820. And now suddenly there was a possibility that states like Kansas and Nebraska and indeed the entire Western territories might be open to slavery and the expansion of slavery. And this mightily disturbed anti-slavery opinion in the North and more moderate Northerners who thought that the issue of slavery's expansion has, as I say, been settled a generation earlier. And this became such a hot issue in 1854 that men who were the voters in those days came together and began forming anti-Kansas-Nebraska parties, having conventions, and eventually they took the name Republican as a way to describe the political party they were creating.
And their first candidate for president of the United States was not the man we most closely identify with the start of the Republican Party, Abraham Lincoln.
No, they chose the famous explorer and soldier John C. Fremont, who was not a very good candidate, but he was a very well-known candidate, and for a party just starting out, he seemed to have name recognition and popularity. And he did reasonably well against James Buchanan. They lost, but they had hopes that they would prevail in another 4 years, which turned out to be correct.
Now, like a lot of members of the future Republican Party, when it started, Abraham Lincoln was a Whig.
Yes, he had been a staunch member of the Whig Party in Illinois, and he believed in the economic nationalism, the protective tariff, using government to promote the growth of the economy that the Whigs stood for. And many of those ideas were subsumed into the Republican Party, adding on to their anti-slavery expansion ideology. But the pro-business, using the power of government to encourage entrepreneurs, these became key elements in the Republicanism as it evolved.
And, of course, when he was elected president of the United States, it was taken as a virtual declaration of war by the South. And he had even one of his most famous statements about the slavery issue in the famous Lincoln-Douglas debate was that a house divided against itself cannot stand. And you argue that what he was saying in that is that either the country will become all free or slavery will expand.
Yes, that's what he believed. Now, he did not say that we ought to get rid of slavery instantaneously. He said we should put it in the course of ultimate extinction, making a societal decision that slavery was going to go and then negotiate with the South the terms of the funeral and the internment. Mm-hmm. But the problem was the South saw where Lincoln was going, and they wanted to expand slavery and because of their view that African Americans were a form of property and a person should be able to take their property wherever they wanted. So the ideology of the South was the expansion of slavery. The ideology of the Republicans was the constriction of slavery. So slavery was the issue of the Civil War, and there was a fundamental cleft in the Republic at this point that brought on the violence of the Civil War.
Now, in the process of prosecuting the Civil War, the Republican Party under Abraham Lincoln adopted a lot of policies, ideologies even, that might seem a little alien to Republicans today. It instituted a graduated income tax. It was an active Federalist Party that prompted things like the Transcontinental Railroad.
Yes, the economic nationalism of the Republicans in the mid-19th century, the real issue was not how to regulate an industrial society, our problem, but their problem was whether the government should encourage the growth of an industrial society. The Democrats in those days, as you'll hear tomorrow, were the party of small government, states' rights, white supremacy, by and large, and so the Republicans were the party of economic nationalism, national power, and using the government to distribute land, to create the transcontinental railroads, to abolish slavery, to do the government as a promotional enterprise rather than a regulatory enterprise.
Mm-hmm. Now, given that, can you trace any principles, any ideas that animated the Republican Party at its inception that continue today?
Well, the most basic one that I discovered had reaffirmed was the notion that the Republicans are inherently more patriotic than the Democrats. And that emerged from the Civil War, having prosecuted a war to save the Union, in which the Democratic Party, it must be said, sometimes consorted with the South and outright flirted with appeasing the South and letting slavery continue to exist. The Republicans thought of that as treason, and they believed that the Democratic Party at its heart was inherently, if not treasonous, susceptible or had leanings in that direction. As the wife of one senator put it after the war, the Republican Party had saved the Union. It was the Union. And this sense that the Democrats are not as legitimate a political party as the Republicans is a kind of red thread that runs through the 154-year history of the party and can be seen even in our current situation in the last 3 or 4 years.
In terms of questioning the patriotism even of some Democrats.
Yes, the criticism, that criticizing the war in Iraq is not simply a policy judgment, but is a sense of criticizing the whole nature of the American Union, the institutions of the presidency and Congress, and that sense that Democrats are not as much American as Republicans is a theme that has run through all the party's deliberations.
Certainly a big part of the Cold War. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We're talking with Lewis Gould about his new book, Grand Old Party, A History of the Republicans. And let's take a call from David, who's with us from St. Augustine, Florida.
Yes, hello, Neil and Lewis. How are you today?
Very well, thanks.
Yeah, I wanted to bring up a little bit of history here. In 1964, after Goldwater's defeat, many of the racist Southern Dixiecrats bolted the Democratic Party and joined the Republican Party. And I think we see that influence now, where the racism has become more subtle, but it's equally damaging, and it keeps African Americans and other people of color in second-class citizenship. It subtly overturned some of the progress that was made earlier during the modern civil rights era of the 60s. Just any comments on that, Lewis?
Well, I think the Republicans would say on their side that that they found themselves having appealed to blacks throughout most of their history up to the late 50s, that the African Americans had become solidly Democratic and resisted even when the Republicans were more for civil rights than the Democrats were, which was true until the early 60s. That even that, they hadn't been able to make any inroads into the black vote. And so, as Barry Goldwater would say, let's go hunting where the ducks are, and the ducks turned out to be largely white male ducks, and they turned to the southern states for electoral support, arguing that it wasn't a matter of race, but more a matter of a underlying philosophy of small government, states' rights, restraining the power of government. I think they sometimes forget how much racial issues affect that congeries of ideas, but how it all sorts out and what people's motives are, I don't try to get into that in the book.
Right, and they also ignore the fact that states' rights during the Civil War era and today is often used as a code word to just cover up the real agenda, which is white supremacy and the domination still by the white race over other races in this country. And I just see it as a code word. It's very ashamed, I think, that the once great party of Lincoln and Douglas have been subverted now to this level where you have many Republicans attacking the most basic gains that were made under the civil rights era of the 60s and attempting to roll back progress.
Well, Lewis Gould, let me ask you about this, and this argument goes back a long ways. It's you don't have to go back to Barry Goldwater, but more about him later. But back to the Tilden Hayes election, not too long after Abraham Lincoln, when many people would argue the Republican Party sold out Reconstruction and sold out the American blacks then.
Well, that argument is certainly made. The problem that existed was, and that the dilemma the Republicans were in the 19th century was, if you were going to reconstruct the South and make a biracial, democratic, small-d society, how were you going to do it? You faced the resolute opposition of Southern white Democrats who were never going to accept as legitimate a Republican government. They had tried military rule, albeit not with a great deal of troops, but there was a resistance in the American psyche to the notion of a military governments in the South. If you took the troops out and the whites in the Southern Democrats imposed, as they did, violence on those who voted Republican, it would have required a great expansion of the power of government, perhaps even beyond what we have contemplated, to have imposed a military solution on the South. Having faced all these dilemmas and not really been able to work them out, alas, men in the North got tired of the Southern issue, the underlying racism of some aspects of American society surfaced, and the Republicans decided that they had done as much as they could and sort of gave up, as you indicated, on the experiment of multiracial society in the South and allowed the South to impose segregation, which was as close to slavery as the South could get away with after the Civil War. So it was a tragedy. I think the Republicans failed to come up to their historic obligations. But looking back at it, it's hard to see, if we were sitting where U.S. Grant or Rutherford B. Hayes was, what weapons we would have used, political, economic, and military, to have changed the result.
David, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
The other aspect of the Republican Party, as you look through its history, that a lot of people have trouble reconciling with the small government party, is the presidency of Theodore Roosevelt, who was a dynamo. Do you see him as being in the mainstream of the Republican Party or as an aberration?
Well, he's sort of both. He starts out in the mainstream of the Republican Party as a very conventional politician, but he was very worried about the prospect of a social revolution in the United States at the turn of the century. And we have to remember that socialism was very gaining in popularity. This was before the Russian Revolution, so socialism didn't have the totalitarian connotations it later achieved. And he was fearful that if they didn't make moderate conservative reform changes, that something more dangerous and sweeping might occur. So he said to the Republicans, we've got to regulate the railroads. We have to do something about social justice for child labor, for women in the workplace. We need to provide some kind of old age insurance, even perhaps some medical insurance. And we need to strengthen the power of the government to do all these things. And the Republicans went along for a while because Roosevelt was popular. But the further he went down the road in this direction toward the New Deal, the more restive the Republicans became. And after Taft became president in 1909, in effect, the Republicans said, if this is what you mean, TR, by Republicanism, we're not having any. And they rejected him for the presidential nomination against Taft in 1912. And so a decisive turning point in the party's history occurred.
We'll be talking about the party of small government in the 20th century Republican Party when we come back from a break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the Republican Party, which turns 150 years old later this year. What if you always wanted to know about the party of Lincoln, Roosevelt, William McKinley, Calvin Coolidge, to name just a few? We'll also be talking, of course, about Barry Goldwater, Ronald Reagan, Richard Nixon. Our number, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Lewis Gould, the author of Grand Old Party, A History of the Republicans. And just a note, we'll be talking about Party of the People, A History of the Democrats tomorrow with Jules Whitcover. These two new histories are published by Random House and Just Out. And let's get another listener involved in the conversation. Nate joins us on the line from one of the two places that claims to be the birthplace of the Republican Party, Ripon, Wisconsin.
Yeah, well, we only recognize Ripon as the home of the Republican Party, so we'll let the other guys make a claim. What I'm interested in is Midwestern Republicans, people like Robert Taft and so forth, really led the charge in the 40s, 50s, and 60s for a balanced budget and limited government. And while the Republican Party has had the rhetoric of limited government, none of them have actually cut back on the size of government, whether it's the Bush and Reagan presidencies or the Congress that took over with Newt Gingrich.
Now, you're talking about the second Robert Taft, not the president.
Correct. And what I'm saying is that, you know, it's actually easy to throw money around. And the Democrats get accused of having too many government programs, and the Republicans love to cut taxes, but it takes real political courage, and you have to use political capital in order to cut back on government spending, because let's face it, every program has its supporters and people who benefit from it. With the exception of programs that are targeted to, you know, invalids and with people who are very low income, who never participate politically, so you can, you know, kind of abuse them with impunity. The real programs that are expensive, entitlements, Social Security, and now with the largest unfunded obligation since the Social Security Act, with this Medicare drug benefit, the Republican Party has turned its back. And there's a famous quote of Dick Cheney in the latest book by the former Secretary Paul O'Neill, where he says, well, you know, Reagan proved that deficits don't matter. So it seems like this White House has completely abandoned any pretense at fiscal constraint or you know, control, and it's a flip-flop. It seems strange because there's a real disconnect between the rhetoric and what actually happens.
Lewis Gould?
Well, there is a lot of heartburn now in the ranks of the Republican Party about that, because they do see the restraints on spending and the idea of a limited government disappearing or vanishing like ice cream in the summer sun, as the Bush administration and the Congress have expended great deals of money and have run up rather large deficits. I'm not sure that people who are currently holding dollars overseas would agree with Vice President Cheney that deficits don't matter. We'll see how that works out. But yes, the political will to actually cut spending is not evident in either party, but for the Republicans who've always believed in it, it is perhaps a striking departure from their basic faith.
And let's go back. Thanks very much for the call, Nate. Let's go back to that convention of 1912, which you described as a turning point. That's when the Republican Party really gained a characteristic where one wing of the party really came to dominate.
Yes, the Taft people decided that they might lose the election, but it was more important to retain control of the party than to allow Theodore Roosevelt to become president again. And in getting control of the party, one of the themes of the book, I argue, is that the conservatives really have been in control of the grassroots of the party and the organization ever since. During the New Deal, there was a flirtation with the ideas of nominating more liberal Republicans to appeal to the center of American politics, Wendell Willkie, Thomas E. Dewey, and then eventually Dwight Eisenhower. But the Republicans have long since abandoned what they used to call the Me Too strategy of emulating the New Deal, and have gone for a more undiluted conservatism, though, as your caller just said, conservatism now, it's hard to see just what it consists of. There's a certain ideological schizophrenia in the Republican Party at the moment about where they really stand on the size of government.
Well, as you mentioned, obviously during after the Depression, the Democrats dominated the White House for the next five elections, and then a moderate Republican, Dwight David Eisenhower, at the 1960 convention that would eventually nominate Vice President Richard Nixon for president, Arizona Senator Barry Goldwater let his name be put into nomination for the sole purpose of withdrawing it.
We have lost election after election in this country in the last several years because conservative Republicans get mad and stay home. This country and its majesty is too great for any man, be he conservative or liberal, to stay home and not work just because he doesn't agree. Let's grow up, conservatives. Let's, if we want to take this party back, and I think we can someday, let's get to work.
Barry Goldwater would, of course, be the nominee of the party for president 4 years later and lead it to one of the most disastrous defeats in electoral history.
Yes, he would, but the key to that election is that the conservatives did outwork their liberal, rather lazy liberal adversaries and gain control of the party. I don't think after the Kennedy assassination and what Johnson had accomplished that really any Republican would have had a reasonable chance of winning. Goldwater was a better spokesman than he was a candidate. But in the long run, he prepared the way for Ronald Reagan and conservatism. And so ideologically, he won the battle for the party's heart, even if he lost it at the polls.
Let's get another caller in. Lee joins us on the line from Willows, California.
Hello.
Hi.
In 1964, my parents moved from, registered Republicans, moved from Indiana to northern Alabama. They went to vote in their first primary there, and they asked for a Republican ballot. And the little blue-haired ladies running the polling place all looked at each other very puzzled and said, "Well, I don't know. Do we have any of those here?"
They didn't have any Republican ballots.
No, sir. And so you can
by November, they would have Republicans, though.
Yes, but it was very, very few and very scarce for quite some time.
Which reminds us all, Lewis Gould, that in that election and for a long time, certainly part of the New Deal coalition, the South was the solidly Democratic South, and today it couldn't be any different.
Now it's the solidly Republican South, where the Democrats have virtually no chance of carrying Southern states. And it's, in essence, you've had the those who were voting Democratic or their parents who were voting Democratic in the 50s and 60s have moved over into the Republican ranks. And now it's clear that you either participate in Republican politics or you're effectively shut out of decision making in many Southern states.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks very much for the call, Lee.
You're welcome.
Was this a result of Richard Nixon's so-called Southern strategy in 1968?
Well, that was part of it, but I really think the enactment of the Civil Rights Act in 1964 was, as the famous Johnson quote now, you know, we've given up the South to the Republicans for a generation or two generations or maybe three generations as it now is. But I think the upheavals of the 1960s in the sense that the Democratic Party was no longer the party of white men as it had been down to the late 40s, early 50s until Harry Truman and Hubert Humphrey, that sense of disillusion with the Democrats has carried on through the last half century and helped to shape the way the Republicans are in the South.
Mm-hmm. Now, again, going back to 64, it was then an actor of some small repute by the name of Ronald Reagan who made a single speech on behalf of the conservative Republican candidate for president, Barry Goldwater.
This is the issue of this election. Whether we believe in our capacity for self-government or whether we abandon the American Revolution and confess that a little intellectual elite in a far distant capital can plan our lives for us better than we can plan them ourselves. Outside of its legitimate functions, government does nothing as well or as economically as the private sector of the economy.
Ronald Reagan speaking on behalf of Barry Goldwater back in 1964. And Lewis Gould, you really look upon him as one of the transformative people who've really changed the Republican Party.
Yes, there's the Republican Party before Ronald Reagan, and then there's the party as we know it today afterward. That speech, A Time for Choosing, and Reagan's ability as a candidate and campaigner and president, which probably equals Franklin Roosevelt in terms of sheer skill, The Republican Party did, as I say, sort of spring from Ronald Reagan's forehead after that, and everything is defined in now in where you stood relative to Reagan, how you felt about him, were you loyal enough, do you believe in his legacy, do you think he should be on every public building on the dime, and whatever symbols are around. But in many senses, some of his rhetoric now seems a little out of kilter with the present posture of the administration. And I think whatever happens in 2004, there are some interesting ideological fissures in the party that are going to be, I think, coming out after the next election, win or lose. Lose would be a real bloodbath, but even winning, it may turn out to be some very rigorous inter-party debates are going to occur in the next 4 or 5 years.
Let's get Paul on the line. He's calling from Portland, Oregon.
Hi. My question is related to the first caller from Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
I've been a Republican all my life, the main reason I've been a Republican is I believe that you shouldn't spend more than you have except in dire circumstances. And I don't count the war in Iraq as dire circumstances since I didn't think our country was really threatened. And I think that the Republican Party seems to have strayed from at least its rhetoric of fiscal conservatism. When Reagan was president, he spent a lot, but at least he still talked about fiscal conservatism, fiscal responsibility. And Mr. Bush doesn't even talk about it. I mean, I think he makes no bones about it. He thinks we should just spend a lot of money and go in debt. It doesn't really matter. And I'm wondering, my question is this a great departure, or has the Republican Party, before I was born, did it go through periods of spending a lot and then talking fiscal conservatism and then spending a lot, or is this a departure from its history?
And is this, Lewis Gould, one of the ideological fissures you're talking about?
Yeah, I think the caller well exemplifies the sort of angst that many Republicans are having quietly. They'll vote for Bush, they'll hope he'll get reelected, but there's this uneasy, queasy feeling that somehow they've gone astray. In the 19th century, actually, the Republicans were known as the party of big spending. I mean, it was tiny compared to our amounts, but the Democrats were the party of small, inexpensive government, and the Republicans in 1890, for example, when the government first spent $1 billion in their budget, the billion-dollar Congress was much assailed by the Democrats for being an example of wasteful Republican spending. So there has been a tradition in the 19th century, but certainly since the New Deal, the Republicans have been the party of fiscal restraint, and that tradition, we'll see how long it continues.
I think it's ended already. I'm never going to
You have a point.
Again.
Yeah. Well, Paul, thanks very much for the call.
All right.
And let's get an email question now. I have European friends, writes Gary Romans. I have European friends who've commented to me that it's strange that the USA has only two functional major political parties, where more homogeneous European nations have many. From studying the history of the Democrats and Republicans, can you make suggestions about what it would require for a third major U.S. political party?
A lot of money, a lot of social discontent, and a lot of good luck, because the American political system has been arranged, we won't say rigged, to favor the two parties, especially the Electoral College that gives you the winner-take-all arrangement. This is what Ross Perot found out, that you could get a lot of popular votes and not win any states. And so the whole tilt of American politics has favored the existence of the two major ideologically broad-based political parties. Who knows, we could be in for a situation in the near future where that changes if there's some social crisis or political divisions that we can't anticipate. One wouldn't want to forecast that, but it's not beyond the realm of possibility.
We're speaking with Lewis Gould about his book, Grand Old Party, A History of the Republicans. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And another caller is with us. Tim is on the line from St. Louis, Missouri.
Hello.
Hi, Tim. You're on the air.
Yeah. I wanted to just say that it seems to me that the modern Republican Party is more similar to the party of the 19th century, especially when you look at what the Hayes administration did with the Great Strike of 1877, using federal troops to break the strike very violently. And then as you move towards the early 20th century, the party moved somewhat away with that with Teddy Roosevelt. And then it seems to me what Reagan did was just go back to his roots and the way he broke the Patco strike, in the early 1980s.
The air traffic controllers, yeah.
Yeah, the air traffic control strike. It seems to me the Republican Party's gone back to its roots.
Well, the party has an ambivalence about labor. It likes the individual laborer and wants to diffuse benefits through society to lift everyone up. They are less happy, obviously, with labor unions, and they are unhappy with labor unrest, and they tend to see that as a manifestation of too many Democrats and a leaning in the wrong direction. But they've been able, through the protective tariff and other doctrines, to appeal to the broad mass of American working people with the argument that if you vote Republican, we'll all rise up together. Now, this obviously has not resonated at all times in all places, but Republicans wouldn't believe that they're anti-labor, even though there are those instances correctly that you cite.
I'd just like to respond that I believe that the Republican Party would put property rights and property values ahead of any individual or collective labor rights in this country, and I believe that was true from the 19th century. And except for the period where Teddy Roosevelt had some influence on the party, and it's just gone back to its roots, and that's all I would say about that. So,
Tim, thanks very much.
Thanks for your show today. I appreciate it.
Bye. Okay, we just have a couple of minutes left. Is Lewis Gould? Do you think the Republican Party is now a thoroughly conservative party? Is the moderate wing used to be a lot of northeastern liberal or moderate Republicans? Jim Jeffords just left the party a couple of years ago.
Well, the old line about they used to caucus in a phone booth. I do think that the liberal Republicanism doesn't exist anymore, and its degrees of conservatism, though culturally and socially, especially in a state like New Jersey or in the Northeast, Republicanism is becoming almost as endangered species as Democrats in the South. So there are interesting cultural cross currents, economic currents, ideological currents that are running in the country that suggest perhaps after this election, maybe during this election, we could see some realignments and some changes that make American politics always so fascinating to watch and to write about.
And as always, this next election, of course, is the most crucial ever.
Absolutely. Every election is the most crucial ever until the next one.
Thank you very much, Lewis Gould. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Lewis Gould is the author of Grand Old Party, A History of the Republicans, also professor emeritus in American history at the University of Texas. He joined us from the studios of our member station in Austin, Texas, KUT. When we come back from a break, we're going to be discussing the case of the USS Liberty, an American spy ship that was attacked by Israeli forces off the coast of Egypt during the 1967 Six-Day War. That was the subject of a two-day conference, the 67 War, at the State Department over the past couple of days. They revisited the issue of the attack on the USS Liberty. We're going to explain what happened. If you have questions about what happened and why, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.